Good afternoon. You are tuned to KTOO, and this is Juno Afternoon for Tuesday, July 23rd. My name is Martha Moore. Coming up in the next hour, we'll talk with John Sabella about his documentary Tragedy and Courage on the Bering Sea, showing this week on 360 North. Christy Chambour will give us an update on the Prairie Home Companion KTOO 40th anniversary trip, and we'll learn about next week's Midsummer Vocal Festival. That, Writer's Almanac, Bird Note, music, and more. The forecast today is calling for partly cloudy, chance of rain in the afternoon, highs around 65. Tonight, rain likely, lows around 53.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Native American legal advocates say unless the South Carolina Supreme Court reconsiders its ruling in a controversial adoption case, civil rights violation charges will be filed. Tristan Autone reports last week's ruling in the Baby Veronica case is still stirring emotions in Indian country.
In a press conference Monday, John Echohawk of the Native American Rights Fund accused South Carolina Supreme Court of ignoring due process of law and violating Baby Veronica's civil rights.
In this case, we strongly believe that federal civil rights laws are being violated, that other applicable provisions of the Indian Child Welfare Act are being ignored by the state courts, and that the principles underlying treaty and international law protecting the rights of indigenous peoples are being undermined.
The case involves a 3-year-old named Veronica. She was going to be adopted by a South Carolina couple, but her father, a Cherokee tribal member named Dustin Brown, eventually sought custody. She was returned to Brown under the Indian Child Welfare Act, which gives preference in adoption cases to Native Americans, but the father's custody was challenged by Veronica's adoptive parents. In late June, the U.S. Supreme Court sent the case back to South Carolina, and last week the state Supreme Court ruled Veronica would be removed from her father's custody and placed back with her adoptive parents. Veronica has been living with her father and tribe for a year and a half, and previous rulings found it was in the child's best interest to remain with her father. However, in transferring custody of Veronica to her adoptive parents last week, the courts did not hold a hearing to determine the best interest of the child, and advocates say that skipped step is a violation of her rights and have threatened to pursue a civil rights lawsuit. For National Native News, I'm Tristan Autone.
The Cherokee Nation Monday petitioned the South Carolina Supreme Court to reconsider the ruling it made last week. In South Dakota, a state advocates and tribes say has a long history of violating the Indian Child Welfare Act, the Baby Veronica case is being closely watched. Victoria Wicks reports.
Diane Garrow is ICWA director at Cheyenne River. She spoke up during the news conference announcing the potential lawsuit, saying that a judge in one of her cases invoked the U.S. Supreme Court decision, even though the circumstances are different.
We've been working on this transfer for a while, and everything was going along smooth. They said, Ms. Garrow, we're going to object to your transfer. And the prosecutor, and there was another attorney in the room, and he said, based on the recent Supreme Court ruling. So, I don't know, I'm a little nervous about it, and it's scary. It's scary.
Garrow says she wants tribal organizations to fight to keep ICWA strong. But Daniel Sheehan says the best venue for a fight against ramifications of the Baby Veronica decision is Congress, not the courts. Sheehan is general counsel for the Lakota People's Law Project, which has alleged ICWA violations in the state of South Dakota for a number of years. Sheehan says the Supreme Court decision takes the burden off states in violation of ICWA and puts it on the tribe.
That's what the whole point of Section 1915 is about, is to impose an affirmative burden on the state to reach out and take active efforts to find a Native family and make sure that the child is kept within their culture. That's the point of it. And Alito just blew right over that.
Sheehan says his organization has contacted U.S. Senator Maria Cantwell, who chairs the Senate Committee on Indian Affairs, to ask for changes in federal law to enforce sections of ICWA that currently have no mechanism for enforcement. For National Native News, I'm Victoria Wicks in Rapid City, South Dakota.
During this month in 2012, the Standing Rock Sioux Tribe and U.S. attorneys for South Dakota and North Dakota signed a Memorandum of Understanding. The agreement between the tribe and the U.S. Justice Department authorized the hiring of a special assistant U.S. attorney to prosecute violence against women cases in tribal and federal courts. This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kawanic Broadcast Corporation. with offices in Anchorage, Alaska. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, and the Ford Foundation, and by the law firm of Sanosky, Chambers, Saxe, Miller & Munson, advocating Native American interests throughout the United States, with offices in New Mexico, California, Alaska, and Washington, D.C.
Kuwanek Broadcast Corporation is seeking to fill two positions in our national studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico. We are accepting applications for a senior producer for Native America calling and resource development specialist to sell underwriting. Full job descriptions can be found at nativeamericacalling.com. Click on employment.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
You are tuned to KTOO. This is Juno Afternoon. My name is Martha Moore. In a minute, I'm going to talk with John Sabella, who produced a one-hour documentary which premieres on 360 North this week. The name of the documentary is Tragedy and Courage on the Bering Sea. This is a cut from the film's trailer. The voice you hear is Captain David Shoemaker.
And I turned around and I turned on the fire alarm continuous. Locked it into position. Smoke was filling up that wheelhouse so fast that I could see immediately that this may be a little more serious than what I had anticipated. Now my port raft's gone. The survival suits that I had in the Jacob's ladder box, it's completely engulfed in flames, and now the flames are probably 40 feet up on all sides, and we have another explosion. I'm screaming, do you have everybody? Do you have everybody? Raul, do you have everybody? Yes, Dave! Yes, Dave! Yes, Dave! It's getting further and further until he goes inside and zips the door down and closes it. And they're gone. And I looked right into his eyes, and I remember to this day as I'm looking at you, he said, Captain, are we going to die today? And I said, yes, man.
That was from the documentary Tragedy and Courage on the Bering Sea. I have on the line with me John Sabella, who produced this documentary. Good afternoon, John.
Hi, Martha. How are you?
Great. How are you doing?
Just fine, thank you.
I'm so glad you could be on the program today. What kind of vessel was the Galaxy? How big a crew, and what were the initial events that created the perilous situation that day?
The Galaxy was a 190-foot freezer longliner. On her last voyage, she carried a crew of 26. They were fishing 35 miles from the Pribilofs on a Sunday afternoon. It was business as usual, according to Captain Shoemaker, just another day at the office, he called it. They had 30 to 40 knot winds. They had 20-foot seas. They had just finished hauling an 11-mile string of fishing gear. He had turned the vessel around to go to the beginning of another string, and they were beamed to the seas. They were in the trough, as the fishermen call it. And at about 4 o'clock during a shift break, which also happened to be lunchtime on the Galaxy, they were hit by a very large wave on the starboard side of the hull. And the wave made the vessel roll heavily, so heavily that all the crew members having lunch had their plates land on the floor. They were crawling around on the floor, scrambling after their plates, trying to clean up the mess in the galley. At that point, a processing foreman named Montoya left the fish factory and started up the stairs toward the Galaxy to give Captain Shoemaker the production report from the just completed production run, and on his way up the stairs, he smelled smoke. And he burst into the wheelhouse and alerted Captain Shoemaker to the smoke. And Captain Shoemaker sounded the alarm, the general alarm. He also was very concerned for the welfare of the crew. A lot of the crew members who had just come off shift were in their bunks asleep. And you have to realize that a fishing vessel like this is so incredibly noisy all the time that these men are inured to loud noises, and he feared that some of them might not hear the fire alarm. So he rushed out of the wheelhouse and started banging on doors, on the doors of crew staterooms, to wake people up. By the time he got back to the wheelhouse, the smoke in the wheelhouse and the heat in the wheelhouse were so intense he couldn't get back inside. And within 4 minutes, there had been a huge backdraft explosion that basically destroyed the vessel and most of its survival equipment, and also destroyed all of their safety plans and procedures. This catastrophe occurred so fast, it just overwhelmed the crew. It blew three members of the starboard fire team into the water behind the vessel. They were blown out of about a three-foot square hatch with a lower sill 56 inches off the working deck. So if you can imagine being propelled out of a window 30 feet through the air into the Bering Sea by the force of the explosion, just an astonishing event. Captain Shoemaker used an escape hatch from the wheelhouse and went up onto the very top deck of the vessel, 34 feet above the water at the dock, where the majority of the processing crew, I think 17 men and a woman, had escaped. And they were on the very top deck near the stern railing, which is just three steel horizontal bars, so almost no protection. They were exposed to the wind. They were engulfed in clouds of smoke. And when the vessel went over a 20-foot wave, they were as high as a five-story building. And when they looked down, to their horror, they saw the first mate, the second captain, as he was called, and two of the members of the deck crew in the water. They tried to lower lines, and they actually were able to get a line to each of the three men. And if you can imagine the scene, there were five and six men per line, these tiny, or not tiny, but very thin polypropylene lines attached to mooring buoys and life rings. So as they tried to haul them up, they were arching their backs and straining. They got one member of the crew, a gentleman named Tori DiNuccio, up to the top deck. The mate, Jerry Stevens, was in a life ring and got up to the level of the hatch that he'd been blown out of a few minutes ago, and then he slipped through the life ring and back into the water. The third man who was in the water, a gentleman named Ryan Newhall, the deck boss, climbed onto a buoy, and they started... He grabbed a line, and they lifted him to the level of the escape hatch. And each time the vessel plunged into the trough between the waves, he would swing far out away from the hull. He became like the bob at the end of a plumb line. And when the vessel rose up over the crest of the next wave, he'd swing back and slam into the hull. And he was knocked unconscious by the force of the impact. He fell upside down, and somehow the line that he had been holding on to wrapped around his leg, and he was held by the unconscious upside down by the hatch with his line wrapped around his leg. And his crewmates from above on the housetop were able to lower him back into the hatch, which was now a roaring inferno. He was lowered back onto the working deck, and somehow he managed to make his way through the vessel up three decks to the housetop through this roaring inferno. He had no recollection of having done so. He collapsed on the deck, and several days later, when the Coast Guard was interrogating him and told him what he had done, he said, "I did that?" in complete amazement. The captain made ultimately four attempts to enter the wheelhouse. On the first three attempts, he was unsuccessful in finding a working radio. The first time he grabbed a microphone from a radio and keyed it and started issuing a mayday call, "Mayday, mayday, mayday, this is the Galaxy." When he looked down, the cord had already melted off of the radio so that it was just dangling and it was completely useless. He remembered on another attempt to enter the wheelhouse, he remembered that there were emergency radios in his stateroom. So he opened the door of his stateroom and crawled inside, and that introduced oxygen into the stateroom, which was very hot and had lots of fuel. And he created another backdraft explosion that blew him against a steel bulkhead and ignited his clothing and seared his skin. He said it sounded just like bacon frying. Finally, on the fourth attempt to enter the wheelhouse, he was able to successfully issue a mayday call. He was able to make contact with a radio technician at the Loran station on St. Paul Island, 35 miles away, almost twice the effective range of a VHF. Captain Shoemaker called it divine intervention. The Loran station hadn't been manned in 5 years. Loran is a terrestrial navigation system that's pretty much obsolete now. And this radio technician happened to be in the Loran station working on some equipment, happened to get Shoemaker's call 35 miles away, and was able to alert the Coast Guard. In the meantime, the Coast Guard had forward deployed its aerial assets, helicopters and C-130s, to the area around Bristol Bay because it was king crab season, and the king crab fishery always creates a big workload for the search and rescue personnel. So instead of having helicopters in Kodiak, which would have been 2 hours further away, they had a helicopter forward deployed to Cold Bay. The crew of the helicopter had just returned from a mission. They had just refueled the helicopter. They were still in their flight suits when the emergency call came in. So this was another of these incredible coincidences. They were 2 hours closer to the emergency than they would have been otherwise, and they were able to get airborne in 14 minutes, which is half the time it normally takes a Coast Guard search and rescue aircraft to launch. And so these were more of these incredible coincidences, the 35-mile VHF radio call, the presence of the radio technician in the Loran station, the fact that the helicopter crew was in their flight suits ready to roll. They were able to reach the scene about 4 hours after the initial explosion. Meanwhile, the boat had continued to explode every few minutes. They had welding bottles and acetylene bottles and all of this stuff down below decks, and the vessel was exploding constantly. They had a huge ammonia tank right in front of the front facade of the wheelhouse that was engulfed in flames. They didn't know how, when, or if that was going to explode. The bosun's locker on the foredeck that housed... I think 45 immersion suits for a crew of 26 was engulfed in flames. The immersion suits began to melt on the deck. The port life raft was on fire. The starboard life raft was stowed to weather, so if they launched the starboard life raft, it was going to be pinned against the hull, the hot hull of the boat. And Captain Shoemaker looked over the edge at one point, and he could count the ribs from the water line to the top of the wheelhouse. They were glowing, and every time a wave hit the side of the vessel, enormous clouds of steam went up in the air. There were flames shooting 50, 100 feet above the deck. He was able to get, there were four members of the crew on the foredeck who were isolated from the others, and they were able to retrieve some immersion suits from the bosun's locker, even though it was on fire, and they tied four suits into a bundle, and Shoemaker threw a monkey's fist to the housetop, and Shoemaker was able to raise it. He turned around, and there were 19 sets of eyes beseeching him for some miracle that was going to save their lives, and he had to try and figure out how to distribute the survival suits. He went back to the leading edge of the wheelhouse to get another bundle. And as he was trying to pull it up, an immersion suit weighs about 14 pounds in his bag, and he had they had tied three bundles of these things together, so it was a very heavy weight, several hundred pounds. He was leaning through the railing into the into the heat and smoke of the fire when the vessel rolled and another explosion occurred, and it propelled him through the railing. He fell 20 feet, broke three ribs, and landed on the deck with his skin again sizzling from the heat. When he got up, he tried to go back to the housetop to direct the abandoned ship, but the other members of the crew wouldn't let him. They turned him toward the bow, and he said his socks were catching on fire when he was walking on the deck. It was so hot. His shoes had been thrown off by the force of the impact with the hull. Ultimately, 14 members of the crew at the stern were able to jump for the life raft. It was just a desperate attempt. This was not stepping off the side of a pool into a life raft. This was jumping from a 3 to 5 story building onto a tiny life raft, bobbing over the crests of 20-foot seas. Several members of the crew weren't able to make it for various reasons. The Federal Fisheries Observer, the only woman on board, Ann Weckbach, was one of those who didn't get off in time. She wound up abandoning the vessel in nothing but, I think she had pajama bottoms on and a foul weather coat. She had some boots on, and she kicked those off when she hit the water. She was essentially unprotected in the Bering Sea, where the functional time of a human body is literally measured in minutes. Ryan Newhall, the deck boss, the individual who had been knocked unconscious and lowered back into the gear-setting hatch, had been basically dazed and out of commission most of the time. He realized that she was going to die if she were left on her own, so he happened to have an emergency suit on. He jumped in the water after her. He kept her alive for an hour and a half, which is a medical miracle, before she was retrieved by another fishing vessel. Three members of the processing crew who were afraid to abandon the vessel climbed the stern mast, the aftermast of the vessel, this small centerline mast, and they hung above the fire. They said they were going to, one crew member commented that they thought they were going to be roast chicken up there. At this point, there were holes burning in the steel top deck of the vessel, flames flaring out of the holes in the vessel. And these guys were just clinging above the flames. It was so hot when they leaned inboard that they thought they were going to roast. If they leaned outboard into the wind, it was so cold they thought they were going to freeze. The Coast Guard search and rescue helicopter arrived on the scene and discovered them there. And they lowered a rescue swimmer in a triangle to the level of these three gentlemen on the stern mast. And the rescue swimmer pointed at them, pointed at himself, indicating that he wanted them to emulate what he was going to do. He dropped into the water, and he motioned that the first guy should jump in. These people had no immersion suits on. They were scared to death, but finally one of them jumped in. The rescue swimmer was able to get him into a rescue basket, raise him into the helicopter. By that time, the rescue swimmer had been driven so far from the stern, the helicopter had to go back and collect him. And they went through this three times in a row, and they rescued the three men on the stern mast. Then they turned their attention to three men on the bow, Captain Shoemaker, Assistant Engineer Mirak Slewinski, and deckhand Matt Taylor. The life raft at this point had left, it was no longer attached to the vessel. It had floated away. And the life raft was another just horrible situation. They were in smoke and flames pouring out of the the various openings on the vessel until somebody finally cut the painter and the raft drifted away. When the helicopter approached the bow, when a Good Samaritan fishing vessel approached the bow, Shoemaker waved it away, and his assistant chief engineer, Mirek Slewinski, a Polish man, couldn't believe it. He said, "Captain, what are you doing?" And Shoemaker said, Mirek, they've got to go to the raft." So then Mirak began, and Matt Taylor, the other gentleman, began waving the boat away, and the first boat on the scene went and rescued the people in the raft. There were 15 of them. Another Good Samaritan vessel approached the bow, and Captain Shoemaker ordered Matt Taylor, the deckhand who was wearing an immersion suit, to jump in the water and swim to the boat to advise the crew that there were other people in the water. There were four people in the water, including Weckbach and Newhall, the Federal Observer and the deck boss. So he did that, and that vessel ultimately found Weckbach and Newhall. She was barely alive, but was still alive, and they brought her aboard and treated her for hypothermia. They did it correctly. They didn't put her in a hot bath or try to warm her too quickly. They put her in a bed with in a bunk with hot blankets, and they rotated crew members in to do body-to-body rewarming. And she laughed that she woke up after this incredible ordeal, this absolute medical miracle, to find a naked crew member next to her. And she was, needlessly to say, pretty surprised. She laughed and she said she got to meet them all in the morning.
It's quite a remarkable story. In the few minutes we have left, tell us, why did you choose to narrate the story through the captain, Dave Shoemaker?
Dave Shoemaker is a speaker of the first order. He's a terrific speaker. And when he tells the story, it's just riveting. He's done it before many audiences, and the audiences are always just stunned by the end of the story. Ultimately, 23 of 26 people survived by virtue of the heroism displayed not only by Captain Shoemaker, but by several members of the crew. That's why we call it Tragedy and Courage. Shoemaker got the Coast Guard's Gold Lifesaving Award, which is the highest civilian medal for lifesaving that the agency issues, as did Chief Engineer Raul Vielma and Deck Boss Ryan Newhall. The rescue swimmer Calvin Panupchuk, a native from Shaktulik, received the Coast Guard's Silver Lifesaving Medal. So having Shoemaker narrated is like listening to Abraham Lincoln deliver the Gettysburg Address.
He is quite a storyteller. Along with the narrative, the pictures and the footage do a really good job of supporting the narrative. Where did the images come from?
The video footage was shot by a crew member aboard a Good Samaritan vessel called the Blue Pacific. And needless to say, people had higher priorities that day than taking pictures. So the photography is kind of scattershot. He's able to spend some time at, he's able to use his camera at times, and then he has to attend to other things. So the video photography is amazing that it exists at all. It's not the best in the world, but as you can see when you watch the program, it certainly helps tell the story. The still photographs were taken from the rescue helicopter, from the Black Hawk helicopter, which was piloted by two females, by the way. The pilot was named Melissa Rivera. And Captain Shoemaker said that when it was finally his turn, he was the last man to leave the vessel. This helicopter came nose to the bow of the Galaxy, and he could see the two pilots through the glass on the front of the helicopter smiling at him and waving and saying, "It's your turn." And he jumped off of the bow of the vessel, and when he hit the water, he realized that three of his ribs had been shattered, and he was just seriously, seriously hurt, had major burns over his body. And he was taken to the clinic at St. Paul, airlifted to Anchorage, and ultimately to the burn unit at Harborview Hospital in Seattle, where he recovered.
Why did you make this documentary?
I've been a documentarian for many years. I've made 25 programs about Northwest and Alaska maritime history, and this is by far the most dramatic story that I've ever come across. When I heard Shoemaker tell it, I actually had gone to interview him on a different project, but suddenly he segued to the story of the Galaxy, and I just became transfixed. I couldn't break away. We couldn't turn the camera off, so we wound up spending several hours, much longer than we had imagined, at his house in Carnation, Washington, listening to him tell the story. We originally set out, Captain Shoemaker dedicated his life after he recovered from his injuries to teaching maritime safety and spreading the gospel of maritime safety. He wants to have the lessons learned aboard the Galaxy communicated to seamen around the world in hopes that other tragedies like this can be averted. So we first made a training movie, which we offered to fishing vessel companies and maritime companies around the world. I've subsequently written a book called After the Galaxy, which tells the story in book form. And we shortened the training DVD and have released it as a home viewing DVD. And that's the program that's going to be screened on 360 North Wednesday, Friday, and Sunday, I think.
I'm talking with John Sabella about his new documentary, Tragedy and Courage on the Bering Sea. The documentary, as he just said, airs on 360 North tomorrow at 8 p.m. and 11 p.m., Thursday the 25th at 11 a.m. and 5 p.m., and Sunday the 28th at 7 p.m. It's a remarkable story. It's told in a riveting manner, and it's both educational and very inspiring. So thank you so much, John, for joining us, and thanks for doing this. I recommend everyone watch this. Very important.
Thank you, Martha. We certainly appreciate your support.
Okay, thanks.
Bye.
Thank you. And here is the Writer's Almanac for Tuesday, July 23rd, 2013. It was on this day in 1903 that the Ford Motor Company sold its first car, a two-cylinder Model A. It was sold to a Chicago dentist named Ernest Fenning, who paid $850 for it. The Model A was painted red with a seat that fit two people and no roof. It reached 28 miles per hour at top speed. The Ford Motor Company had just organized a month earlier. There were only 12 stockholders, including Henry Ford himself, who was also the vice president and chief engineer. Ford had $28,000 in investment funds, but by the time the first Model A was sold, the company had just $224 left in the bank. Fewer than 2,000 Model A's sold during the 2 years it was manufactured, but it was enough to make the Ford Motor Company profitable. In 1908, 5 years after selling the first Model A, Ford rolled out its Model T, and the company truly took off. The Model T was the first car produced on assembly lines, and Ford marketed it to the middle class. It's the birthday of Raymond Chandler, born in Chicago, 1888. His parents were Irish, and after his father left the family, his mother moved them back to Ireland, and he grew up there and in England. Later, he moved back to America and settled in California. He wrote pulp fiction about the city of Los Angeles and a detective there named Philip Marlowe. Chandler's first novel was The Big Sleep, which sold well and was made into a movie with Humphrey Bogart and Lauren Bacall. William Faulkner co-wrote the screenplay. Chandler wrote seven more novels featuring Philip Marlowe, who became the quintessential hard-boiled private eye, tough and street smart and full of wisecracks. In Farewell, My Lovely, Marlowe says, "I needed a drink, I needed a lot of life insurance, I needed a vacation, I needed a home in the country. What I had was a coat, a hat, and a gun." Chandler was never good at coming up with plots. He had to study and steal from other mystery writers like Dashiell Hammett, but he knew how to create atmosphere. One of his early stories, Red Wind, begins, "There was a desert wind blowing that night. It was one of those hot, dry Santa Anas that come up down through the mountain passes and curl your hair and make your nerves jump and your skin itch. On nights like that, meek little wives feel the edge of the carving knife and study their husbands' necks. Anything can happen." Chandler is also famous for his metaphors. In one novel he wrote, "She smelled the way the Taj Mahal looked by moonlight." And in another he wrote, "She gave me a smile I could feel in my hip pocket." And here's a poem by Rosanna Warren entitled Mediterranean. "When she disappeared on the path ahead of me, I leaned against a twisted oak. All I saw was evening light where she had been, gold dust light, where a moment before and 38 years before that, my substantial mother strode before me in straw hat, bathing suit, and loose flapping shirt. Every summer afternoon, her knapsack light across her back, her step in sandals firm on the stony path as we returned from the beach. And I mulled small rebellions and observed the dwarfish cork trees with their pocky bark, the wind-wrestled oaks with arms akimbo, while shafts of sea light stabbed down between the trunks. There was something I wanted to say at the age of 12, some question she hadn't answered, and yesterday, so clearly seeing her pace before me, it rose again to the tip of my tongue, and the mystery was not that she walked there 10 years after her death, but that she vanished and let twilight take her place." Mediterranean by Rosanna Warren from her collection Ghost in a Red Hat, published by Norton and used by permission here on the Writer's Almanac. This is Billy Collins, hoping you will join us next time here on the Writer's Almanac.
You've
You are tuned to KTOO. This is Juno Afternoon. My name is Martha Moore, and I have with me Rosie Humphreys, and she's here to talk about the Midsummer Vocal Festival. Hi, Rosie.
Good afternoon. Thanks for having me.
Sure. Thanks for coming in. And what would you like to tell us about the Midsummer Vocal Festival?
Well, I want to invite everybody in Juno who's interested in singing to come down. It's a vocal festival that the Juno Lyric Opera has been putting on for almost 25 years now. Byron McGilvery and Jan Capella come from Texas and basically put on a two-week vocal workshop, and you can learn how to sing with a choir, sing all sorts of different kinds of music. Last year they did Broadway-type music, but this year they're doing some classical pieces, one by Vivaldi. It's called Gloria. They're doing a few pieces from that set, and they're also doing a piece called Lux Aeterna. It's one of those Latin words that you can't always pronounce, but it's supposed to be a beautiful piece written for chorus singers.
And so the workshop is when?
The workshop is starting next week, July 29th through August 9th is the actual days of the workshop. They're going to be weeknights, so Monday through Friday, and they'll be from 7 to 9:30 at the Northern Lights United Church. And the performance is actually also going to be at the Northern Lights United Church on August 10th at 7:30.
Great. And can anyone come? Do you have to? Can you just?
Anybody can come. It's a vocal. It's a workshop.
Pass the test.
Yes, you don't have to pass the test. It's a $95 fee for the workshop, and you're learning quite a bit. So that includes your music, and then the time that you're going to be spending with Byron and Jan. Jan is not only the pianist but also a vocal coach. So she's also doing private lessons while she's here. So if during that workshop you say, you know what, I want some extra time, you can sit with Jan and work on your pieces that you could either bring or the pieces from the workshop.
And this is a Juno Lyric Opera event?
Yeah, Juno Lyric Opera has been part of the Juno community for decades now. They are the ones who put on Hairspray last year. They do a midsummer vocal festival as well as a midwinter. So if you can't do this one this summer, look for us in December, January time to send out announcements regarding our January midwinter festival.
So what kind of a group do you usually get for these?
You know, in the summertime, because everybody's so busy, it's a little bit less. But in the wintertime, they can have 70 to 90 singers. It just kind of depends on what else is happening in the community, too.
Great. So how could someone sign up for this and find out more?
Good. So you can go to our website at junoopera.org, and that lists all of what's coming up for our season. You'll see a listing on the front page of the website, or you can go to the schedule tab on the website, and that lists how much it costs, where the rehearsals are, when the rehearsals are, and the pieces that we'll be doing.
And can you sign up through the website?
You can sign up by calling 586-2742, which is our JLO office. You can go to also our wiki space and sign up there. You can also email me at director@junoopera.org.
Okay, great. So again, this is the Midsummer Vocal Festival. The workshop is from July 29th to August 9th in the evening hours.
In the evening hours.
And the performance is the 10th.
Yes. And you can buy tickets separate for the performance on our website as well as at the jack.org website and through the bookstores.
Okay, great. Well, thanks so much for coming in, Rosie, and wish you luck with this event.
Thank you very much.
Okay.
King Island, when the North Star pulls into the bay, do some chores, then bake a pie.
Watching makes the waiting longer, filling takes the time fly by.
I wipe the chalkboard, stack the books, grade the tests on Paraguay.
Watching makes the waiting
And that's a cut from King Island Christmas, which is a topic of discussion on tomorrow's Juno Afternoon about the performances this weekend. You are tuned to KTOO. This is Juno Afternoon. My name is Martha Moore, and I have Christy Chambor here in the studio with me. And she's
Hiya.
She's here to tell us about a Prairie Home Companion KTOO 40th anniversary trip. So I think probably most of our listeners have heard the PSAs about this trip, but maybe haven't had a chance to pay attention to all the details or give it serious thought. So tell us exactly what this is.
Well, we're celebrating our 40th anniversary, and we thought, what better way than to go to St. Paul in the fall? So we've put together a land package for our listeners. It's $750 per person, and what we're doing is spending three nights at the St. Paul Hotel. We're going to do a nice tour of NPR studios while we're there. We're also going to have a fun welcome reception with Alaskan Brewing Beers at Patrick McGovern's, which is a really cool local little place over there. And then, of course, Saturday will be the live broadcast of the show, which we're really, really excited about. And then Sunday, come on home.
Wow, that's great. Yeah, St. Paul should be really nice then.
Yeah, it'll be a great time of year to be there.
So, just curious, is the beer, do they sell that there?
Yes.
All the time, or do you have to haul it up?
No, actually, they have a really wonderful sales rep there, Sean Rupke, and he and I have been in touch. They've been great. He is actually the one who directed us to Patrick McGovern's and kind of helped put that little portion of the package together. So we're excited to be able to partner with our local brewery in Minnesota, ironically.
So what does the cost cover and what does it not cover?
So it covers everything on the land portion of the itinerary. We figured there are so many Juno folks that have miles and companion tickets. We thought if we kind of included the air, it would just make it a little more complicated, and we wanted to make it as easy as possible for people to join us. So you get there on your own, you can tag it on to a trip you're already taking, or you know, use your miles, treat yourself to a first class ticket, whatever you want to do, and then we take care of the land portion from there.
And how many people can sign up for this?
We have room for up to 30.
Uh-huh. And how many people have
signed
up?
Right now we have confirmed 11, but interestingly enough, on the ticket side of things at the Fitzgerald Theater, there's a lot of people with Minnesota roots from Juneau, we're finding out, and a lot of relatives and this and that who want to actually be a part of our group while we're there. So we have 30 tickets sold for the actual show. So we've got people joining us from all over the place who will be a part of our Juneau group at the Fitzgerald. But there's 11 right now signed up out of Juneau, which we're excited about.
Wow, what a great Juneau party.
It's going to be fun.
So what's the deadline for signing up?
We'd like to have everybody signed up and on the list because we need to firm up tickets with the Fitzgerald no later than Friday. And then we do have a little more leeway on the land portion, but we have to firm up with the Fitzgerald no later than, I think, Monday. So I'd like everybody to let me know by Friday
and
if you're joining us.
And what should they do to let you know?
They can go onto the website, which is ktoo.org/anniversary, or if you just go to the main page, you'll see a little tab in the corner. Click on that. It takes you to a registration page, and I get those emails directly. Alternately, if you're a talker, give me a call. 463-6426 is my direct line here.
Okay. And then the reception will be with Garrison Keillor?
We do not have confirmation of that. It will be with our friends from NPR Studios. They're probably going to join us. It's after work, happy hour-ish time. So the thought is we're going to do the studio tour at around 3 o'clock on Friday, and then basically just all walk over to Patrick McGovern's together and have a little bit of a soiree.
Okay, great. This is the KTOO 40th anniversary trip to Prairie Home Companion, and I think this is a great opportunity to take advantage of, and it goes to a very good cause.
Yes.
Which is our radio station.
That's, yes, programming at K2. So very important.
Yeah, thanks for coming in, Christy.
Thank you.
And, yeah, I hope this works out
really well.
Okay, thanks.
Bye.
Note. Today, we have a special guest.
What was that?
It must have been a great horned owl. Did you know that great horned owls almost always hunt at night? I'm Emily, a fourth grader at school in the woods. I love the great horned owl's call. Great horned owls hunt from their excellent ears. The first way they hunt is they locate their prey from small movements on the ground. Next, they dive down at just the perfect moment. Finally, they catch their prey with huge talons on the feet. Young great horned owls are fed voles and rabbits until they are about 4.5 months old. After that, they have to fend for themselves. Bird note writer Francis Wood says, "As nestlings, some shuffle out to the nearest branch, while others take the big leap. The young owls practice flying by taking short, cautious flights to nearby branches on neighboring trees before they depart the nesting area." Young owls' first hunting forays are clumsy. They catch no more than large insects and sometimes sick or young mammals. Hey, there's that great horned owl again, but this time I'm hearing hooting instead of screeching.
BirdNote thanks families and teachers who inspire in young people a love of birds and natural science. School in the Woods is in Colorado. Find a link to it at birdnote.org.
And that's it for today's Juno Afternoon. Thanks for joining me, and thanks to all our guests today. To listen to any of today's interviews or any other Juno Afternoon programs, visit the KTOO.org website under Local Programs and Juno Afternoon. Please join us tomorrow at 3. The host will be Lisa Fu. Phil Monday will be here with details about the Ted Stevens Day celebration. We'll find out about this week's performances of King Island Christmas. We'll talk to Amy Courtney from the Audubon Society about this Saturday's July Nature Walk. That, Writer's Almanac, music, and more, tomorrow at 3 on KTOO-FM. Tonight, increasing clouds, scattered showers developing late, lows around 53, Wednesday showers, highs around 64. This is KTOO Juno. We broadcast at 104.3 FM in downtown Juno and Douglas. KTOO also broadcasts on these translators. In the Valley and Auk Bay area, tune to K276 AF 103.1. In Lemon and Schweitzer Creek, K269 AO at 101.7. Gustavus listens on K201 AM 88.1. K220 BT serves Hoonah at 91.9. In Excursion Inlet and Icy Strait, hear KTOO on K210 AS 89.9. In Juneau, you can also receive KTOO on GCI Cable Juneau on digital channel 871. KRNN can be heard at digital channel 872, and KXLL can be found at 873. We are also online at www.ktoo.org. Stay tuned for All Things Considered.